CBS Radio at 50, an autobiography in sound, a special three-hour CBS News anniversary broadcast. Now here again is correspondent Walter Cronkite.
We've come two-thirds of the way along our course, looking back at the various aspects of CBS Radio's first half century, reliving the network's development in music, sports, entertainment, and the early days of news. Radio, as we've noted, developed along many different paths. Another one was drama. Radio drama was a staple of the Columbia Broadcasting Network from the beginning. From those earliest days in 1927, CBS was eager to experiment and to discover new talent. In 1929, 2 years after Columbia became a network, the Columbia Artist Bureau was organized as a CBS subsidiary to manage and supply the network with talent. It also became a training ground for rising radio stars and fostered the creative climate necessary for prestige drama at the network to flourish in the years to come. Drama on CBS Radio, coming up.
And now, Bill Schallert for General Electric.
New Yorkers have a saying about New York City. It'll be a nice place, they say, if they ever get it finished. Because like most cities, New York is changing every day. Old buildings coming down, new buildings going up. And in the process, a lot of the past just disappears. Take what's happened on Pearl Street, number 255 to be exact. Today, that address is a parking lot. Tomorrow, some new building will probably go up there. But yesterday, about 100 years ago, 255 Pearl Street was the scene of an event that changed all our lives. For it was on Pearl Street that Thomas Edison built this country's first central power plant. Inside was an electric generator that would provide light for 85 customers. Edison himself switched on the lights for some of those customers. It wasn't a very impressive premiere because the lights went on in mid-afternoon, but by 7 o'clock it was darkening, and all those gleaming Edison bulbs became a marvel indeed. That day on Pearl Street, September 4th, 1882, a revolution started. Year by year it spread. More and more of America became electrified. And General Electric, the company Edison helped start, was building power plants bigger and bigger. The Pearl Street plant had served 85 customers. Half a century later, GE was working on generators that could serve 25,000 customers, and there were bigger yet to come. Too bad that first little power plant on Pearl Street has disappeared. It could be a tourist attraction as big as Fifth Avenue or the Empire State Building. But if you're ever in New York, you might like to go down there anyhow, Pearl Street. If you've got a good imagination, maybe you'll hear the whir of that first little Edison generator. It's a sound that, like the whir of generators today, was a sound of progress. Progress for people, from General Electric.
Now again, correspondent Walter Cronkite with our golden anniversary special broadcast on the first 50 years of CBS Radio.
Programs for young people were an early interest of the radio network, an interest that continues today, incidentally, with the CBS Radio Adventure Theater. Jack Armstrong, the All-American Boy, one of the longest-running juvenile adventure series, was first heard on the air over CBS in 1933. The next year, Nyla Mack, one of the first women directors, began her 20-year-long drama series for children called Let's Pretend.
Hello, hello, come on, let's go, it's time for Let's Pretend. With magic and with make-believe, our own real special blend. A fairy tale comes true now, from start right to the end. So everyone come join the fun, come on and let's pretend.
Hello, pretenders. Today, how would you like one of the best-known, best-loved stories of all time?
We love it!
All right, then. Let's have Cinderella. Shall we start off to meet her right away?
Well, just as soon as Bill looks at Cinderella.
There was something for every taste on the network down the years. Detectives like Mr. Keene and Nick Charles. Thrillers like Suspense and Inner Sanctum. And true-to-life stories with plenty of crime, such as Gangbusters, which made the claim to be the only national program to bring its listeners authentic police case histories.
The CBS Radio Network presents Gangbusters.
On another plane from Gangbusters, there was Lights Out, which was not for the faint-hearted.
Lights Out brings you stories of the supernatural and the supernormal, dramatizing the fantasies and the mysteries of the unknown. We tell you this frankly. So if you wish to avoid the excitement and tension of these imaginative plays, we urge you calmly, but sincerely, to turn off your radio now.
Any discussion of radio drama would be incomplete without the soap opera. By the late 1930s, there were some 20 daytime series running on CBS. And a 1950 survey reported that more than half of the nation's housewives listened to Ma Perkins and Our Gal Sunday, both CBS programs. The longest running was The Romance of Helen Trent, which was on CBS for 27 years of protracted agony while holding out the hope of eternal romance to its audience.
Once again, we bring you the romance of Helen Trent, who sets out to prove for herself what so many women long to prove, that because a woman is 35 or more, romance in life need not be over. That romance can live in life at 35 and after.
Daytime dramas also provided what some might call philosophy to live by.
And now, life can be beautiful.
In every age, there is a constant search for, in its larger sense, beauty. Mark Akenside wrote a poem in the early 18th century called The Pleasures of Imagination, and it's this verse. Alas, how faint, how slow the dawn of beauty and of truth breaks the reluctant shades of Gothic night, which yet involve the nations. But perhaps finally, in this, our generation, the goal will be reached, and all nations will come out of the night into a fuller realization that only through understanding life can be beautiful.
The soap operas allowed listeners to indulge their secret fantasies.
Once again, we present Our Gal Sunday, the story of an orphan girl named Sunday who was left on the steps of the cabin of two old miners who raised her from childhood in the little mining town of Silver Creek, Colorado, who, in young womanhood, married England's richest, most handsome lord, Lord Henry Brinthrop. The story that asks the question, can this girl from a little mining town in the West find happiness as the wife of a wealthy and titled Englishman?
Best of all, the soap opera plots were so complex as to provide the audience food for thought until the next thrilling installment.
You? Is anybody?
And now the Goldberg. Molly Goldberg is excited about the matchmaking that she's doing. With docile and lovely Emma working in the Goldberg house, Molly can think of nothing better than to try to be helpful. Especially since Bruce Hanley, Mary Foote's brother-in-law, has a nice farm and is something or other essential and so on. This pretty and sentimental country romance is Molly's idea, but we know the real side. The curious, almost evil character of Emma and the fascination she exercises on Molly's son. We know how Emma has lied to everyone, fooled everyone, how she has wound herself into Sammy's life like some parasitic vine. And now we know how she is using Molly's cheerful little plan to force Sammy into an open statement. And now, as they stand on the orchard hill overlooking the house.
In a different kind of drama, a milestone was achieved on CBS Radio with the coming of theatrical productions presented in single evening broadcasts. Lux Radio Theater had its debut on CBS in 1935.
Welcome, everyone, to Hollywood and to another hour in the Lux Radio Theater. And now, we present Hollywood's foremost producer, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Cecil B. DeMille.
Greetings from Hollywood, ladies and gentlemen. Gary Cooper and Gene Arthur were born to the roles they play tonight. Mandrake Falls, where our play opens, might have been any one of the prairie towns Gary once called home, while the town Mr. Deeds goes to is the town Jean Arthur came from, New York. Now, we present the stars and the story. Ladies and gentlemen, the Lux Radio Theater spotlights Mr. Deeds Goes to Town, starring Gary Cooper.
I just want to see if this thing fits my new bass horn all right.
Mr. Deeds, we have some news for you.
Yeah. I suggest you sit down, though, Mr. Deeds.
Mr. Deeds, does the name of Martin W. Semple mean anything to you?
Not much. An uncle of mine, I think, although I never saw him.
Well, he passed on. He was killed in a motor accident in Italy.
He was? Now, that's too bad. If there's anything I can do...
Mr. Semple left a great fortune when he died. He left it to you, Mr. Deeds. Deducting taxes, it's somewhere in the neighborhood of $20 million.
Well, for crying out loud.
Perhaps you didn't hear me, Mr. Deeds. I said the whole Semple fortune goes to you. $20 million.
Oh, I heard you all right. $20 million. That's quite a bit, isn't it?
Oh, it'll do in a pinch.
Yes, indeed. I wonder why he left all that money to me. I don't need it.
Lux Radio Theater aired for 19 seasons on CBS. Another aspect of serious drama came into its own on CBS Radio in the late 1930s. In 1936, the Columbia Workshop, an experimental theater, was inaugurated. Its 1937 production of Archibald MacLeish's verse drama called Fall of the City is still remembered. Another of the workshop's illustrious presentations was Shakespeare's Richard III.
Today, the Columbia Workshop, radio's foremost laboratory of writing and production techniques, has the honor to present the Old Vic Theatre Company of London, England. Their first radio appearance in the United States, a special hour and one-half arrangement of the tragedy of King Richard III by William Shakespeare, with Laurence Olivier in the role of Richard and Ralph Richardson as the narrator.
If Richard III touches deeper chords of terror than the preceding plays, the reason is not to be found in the greater violence of the historic events it traces, but in the character of Richard himself. Here is Richard.
Since this world affords no joy to me, but to command, to check, to all bear such as are of better person than myself, I'll make my heaven to dream upon the throne, and whiles I live to account this world but hell, until my misshaped trunk that bears this head be round impaled with a glorious crown. But yet I know not how to get the crown, for many lives stand between me and home, and I, like one lost in a thorny wood that rents the thorns and is rent with the thorns, seeking a way and straying from the way, not knowing how to find the open air, but toiling desperately to find it out, torment myself to catch the English crown, and from that torment I will free myself, or hew my way out with a bloody axe. Why, I can smile and murder whiles I smile, and cry content to that which grieves my heart, and wet my cheeks with artificial tears, and frame my face to all occasions. I'll drown more sailors than the mermaid shall. I'll play the orator as well as Nestor, deceive more slyly than Ulysses could, and, like a Sinon, take another Troy. I can add colors to the chameleon, change shapes with Proteus for advantages, and send the murderous Machiavel to school. Can I do this, and cannot get a crown? But were it further off, I'd pluck it down.
Over the years, certain radio broadcast dramas were unique and are considered classics today.
One was
Suspense.
And one of the plays in the Suspense series was called Sorry, Wrong Number. It starred Agnes Moorhead, virtually the only member of the cast, and was the story of an invalid woman confined to bed who overhears her own murder being plotted on a cross telephone line.
Hello?
Hello? Hello, is Mr. Stevenson there?
Hello? Hello?
Hello?
Hello? Hello, George?
Yes, boss, this is George speaking.
Hello, who's this? What number is this, please?
I'm here with our client.
Oh, good. Is everything set up for tonight?
Well, yes, George. He says everything is set up.
Good.
What number is this, please?
At 11:15, a train crosses the bridge. It makes a noise in case her window is open and she should scream.
Hello?
Remember, George, make it quick. Our client doesn't wish her to suffer long.
Oh. I'll use a knife, then.
Honestly.
Police station, precinct 43, Sergeant Martin speaking.
Police department? This is Mrs. Stevenson. Mrs. Albert Smythe Stevenson of 53 North Sutton Place. I'm calling up to report a murder. The murder hasn't been committed yet, but I overheard plans for it over the telephone, over a wrong number that the operator gave me.
Yes, ma'am.
Two men were talking, and they were going to murder some woman at 11:15 tonight. She lived in a house near a bridge. Are you listening to me?
Yes, ma'am.
It's just unnerved me dreadfully, and I'm not well.
Well, we'll look into it, Mrs. Stevenson, see if we can check it with the telephone company.
Check it! Personally, I feel you ought to do something far more immediate and drastic than just check the call. I'd say the whole thing calls for a search. A complete and thorough search of the whole... Yeah, I'm very near the bridge, and I'm not talking... Oh, for heaven's sake, I'm going to be out of my mind! Hello! Hello, stop ringing me! Do you hear? Answer me! Who is this? Do you realize you're driving me crazy? Who's calling me? What are you doing it for? Now, stop it! Stop it! Stop it! I say, hello! If you don't stop ringing me, I'm going to call the police. You hear? The police! If Albert would only come. Give me the police department.
One moment, please. I will connect you.
Please. Get the police. Somebody's got to hurry. Get the police, please. What do you want? Oh, don't come near me. Please, I haven't heard anybody. Please, I haven't. Please don't hurt me. Please, I haven't done anything.
Police department? Sorry, wrong number. Don't worry, everything is okay here.
Norman Corwin's On a Note of Triumph is considered another radio classic. Here's an excerpt of that broadcast, which aired in 1945, just before the end of World War II, and earned CBS 1,000 immediate phone calls of congratulations in New York and more than that number in Hollywood.
By popular request, the Columbia Broadcasting System presents a repeat performance of On a Note of Triumph, a special broadcast written, directed, and produced by Norman Corwin for the Day of Victory. Martin Gable is narrator, and the music is by Bernard Herrmann.
Is victory a sweet dish, or isn't it? And how do you think those lights look in Europe after 5 years of blackout going on to 6? Brother, pretty good. Pretty good, sister. The kids of Poland soon will know what an orange tastes like. And the smell of honest-to-God bread, freshly made and sawdust-free, will create a stir in the streets of Athens. There's a hot time in the old town of Dnipropetrovsk tonight. And it is reasonable to assume the same goes for 1,000 other cities, including some Scandinavian. It can at last be said without jinxing the campaign, somehow the decadent democracies, the bungling Bolsheviks, the saps and softies, were tougher in the end than the brown shirt bully boys, and smarter too, for without whipping a priest, burning a book or slugging a Jew, without corralling a girl in a brothel or bleeding a child for plasma, far-flung ordinary men, unspectacular but free, rousing out of their habits in their homes, got up early one morning, flexed their muscles, learned as amateurs the manual of arms, and set out across perilous plains and oceans to whop the bejeepers out of the professionals, This they did.
The CBS Mercury Theater, which was directed by Orson Welles, is perhaps remembered by more people than any other radio drama series. Welles' 1938 production of The War of the Worlds was so realistic it had national repercussions. The story opens with a supposed news flash, interrupting a program in progress to tell listeners that Martians have landed in New Jersey and are spreading death and destruction in their wake. CBS put the script through 38 changes before broadcast in order to stress that it was only a story, fiction. Even so, many listeners were fooled and believed Martians had invaded our planet. Here's part of the dramatic conclusion of War of the Worlds.
This is the end now. Smoke comes out, black smoke drifting over the city. People in the streets see it now. They're running toward the East River, thousands of them, dropping in like rats. Now the smoke's spreading faster. It's reached Times Square. People are trying to run away from it, but it's no use. They're falling like flies. Now the smoke's crossing 6th Avenue. 5th Avenue. 100 yards away. It's 50 feet.
CQ. 2X2L calling CQ, New York. Is there anyone on the air? Is there anyone on the air? Is there anyone?
This is Orson Welles, ladies and gentlemen. Out of character, to assure you that the War of the Worlds has no further significance than as the holiday offering it was intended to be. The Mercury Theater's own radio version of dressing up in a sheet and jumping out of a bush and saying boo. Starting now, we couldn't soap all your windows and steal all your garden gates by tomorrow night, so we did the next best thing. We annihilated the world before your very ears and utterly destroyed CBS. You will be relieved, I hope, to learn that we didn't mean it and that both institutions are still open for business. So goodbye, everybody, and remember, please, for the next day or so, the terrible lesson you learned tonight. That grinning, glowing, globular invader of your living room is an inhabitant of the pumpkin patch, and if your doorbell rings and nobody's there, that was no Martian, it's Halloween.
This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Drama on CBS Radio. It prospered for many years, and then at the end of the 1950s, withered and virtually disappeared. A decade and a half later, with a new generation of listeners, the CBS Radio Mystery Theater, a one-hour drama each night of the week, was born and is heard today. A look at CBS News in the past 25 years when our anniversary broadcast continues.
You are listening to CBS Radio at 50, an autobiography in sound, a three-hour CBS News anniversary broadcast. And now, Bill Schallert for General Electric.
It's been said that the reason we should study history is to be certain we don't repeat the mistakes of others. But another good reason for us to look back into the past is to see how far we've come. This gives us a measurement of progress, something General Electric has been interested in for years. An important example of progress occurred recently in Milwaukee, where GE designs and builds medical equipment. It was there that GE unveiled a new X-ray machine, a computerized tomographic machine designed to scan the total body. In less than 5 seconds, this machine takes tens of thousands of X-ray readings on any part of the body. Then a computer assembles them into pictures that provide much more detail than ordinary X-rays. It helps doctors locate tumors, identify cancers, and analyze problems of many vital organs. It lets doctors see things they could never see before, without surgery. Now, that's a pretty good measure of progress when you consider the first X-ray was discovered in 1895. And here's something you probably don't know. The first X-ray operation in America was performed by a New York doctor using an X-ray machine built by Thomas Edison, one of GE's founders. By the turn of the century, there were many X-ray machines being made. All of them, including Edison's, were highly unreliable. It took a young man by the name of Dr. William Coolidge to change that. In 1913, Coolidge was working at the General Electric Research Lab in Schenectady. He developed what was called the hot cathode tube. That tube became the basis for all modern X-ray. No matter how advanced an X-ray machine is today, it still depends on the progress made by Dr. Coolidge. Progress for people, from General Electric.
CBS Radio at 50, an autobiography in sound. Here again is CBS News correspondent Walter Cronkite to continue with the third and final hour of our special broadcast commemorating the golden anniversary of the CBS radio network.
News was never absent from CBS radio. In recent years, it has become the heart of the network's schedule. Hourly newscasts around the clock pioneered on CBS radio. Six of the 7 a.m. radio stations owned by CBS inaugurated and prospered with all news formats in the decade of the late 1960s and early 70s. In an earlier segment of this special broadcast, we listened to the development of broadcast news in the early years. And now we'll look back at CBS News over its second quarter century, from 1952 until 1977. CBS News emerged from World War II as a tested, maturing organization. In those days during the war, radio proved a vital link between the people at home and developments abroad. In the process of meeting that challenge, CBS News became a professional, worldwide news organization, developing guideposts, precedents, policies, and standards as they were needed along the way. Trying to review all the news events that occurred in the last 25 years is, of course, an impossible task. So we thought we would confine ourselves to some of the people and events which most influenced our lives, changed our thinking, renewed our faith, shaped our future, and not so incidentally, also shaped the development of how news is broadcast. The biggest stories radio news covered were the various sorts of wars that involved our country. The Cold War, as President Dwight D. Eisenhower defined it for the nation.
The world is in a ideological struggle, and we're on one side, and the Iron Curtain countries are on the other. This struggle we now are in, we call the Cold War. We are engaged in a war of great ideologies. This is not just a casual argument between slightly differing philosophies. This is light against dark, freedom against slavery. It is godliness against atheism. That's where we're standing today. That is the struggle.
That ideological struggle went from cold to hot in a very short time. In 1950, we sent troops to Korea as the spearhead of a United Nations force confronting an assault by communist North Korea and backed by the Red Chinese. During the Eisenhower administration, an armistice was finally signed in the summer of 1953, and many thought U.S. military involvement abroad would end. Instead, it spread throughout Southeast Asia and elsewhere. It was gradual at first. In 1957, the United States gave limited money and materiel to the French in Vietnam who were fighting local communists. U.S. involvement there, on an increasing scale, did not end for almost 20 years. President Eisenhower explained why, in those early years, Indochina, as was called then, was so important to the national interest.
If Indochina goes, several things happen right away. The Kra Peninsula, the last little bit of end hanging on down there, would be scarcely defensible. The tin and the tungsten that we so greatly value from that area would cease coming. But all India would be outflanked. Somewhere along the line, this must be blocked. Must be blocked now.
And that's what the French are doing. So when the United States votes $400 million to help that war, we're not voting for a giveaway program. We're voting for the cheapest way that we can prevent the occurrence of something that would be of the most terrible significance to the United States of America. Our security, our power and ability to get certain things we need from the riches of the Indonesian territory and from Southeast Asia.
Over the years, the deeper the involvement, the more money it cost. In 1965, U.S. troops and materiel were sent to Vietnam in large numbers for the first time. The outgrowth of a still controversial naval engagement involving U.S. ships in the Gulf of Tonkin. At home, Vietnam increasingly thereafter became an issue that divided the country, not fully resolved even by the day in 1975 when U.S. troops finally pulled out and left that devastated peninsula to the communist forces of South Vietnam, the Viet Cong, and to the Vietnamese of the North. Here is CBS News correspondent Bruce Dunning describing the scene at the huge U.S. base at Da Nang as one of the last evacuation planes tried to fly out that day in 1975 and terrified South Vietnamese soldiers and civilians surged onto the airfield trying to force their way aboard the plane.
We're trying to get them on as quickly as we can. They're holding onto the air stair. There's a sea of humanity jamming on. Impossible to stop the crowd. People are falling off the air stairs. We've got about a half dozen people on the plane. Another dozen are there running along, grabbing at the air stair. Our plane is surrounded here. I don't know how the hell we're going to get out, but we're loading the people on as fast as we can. Women and children are obviously being left behind. All around the plane, there are people with children, women, standing around, but it's the men who don't have any who are getting on fastest. They're the ones that are jamming up the stairs. We've gotten on about three or four children and a couple of women, and that's all. They've torn apart the railing. The plane is rolling. People are still trying to crawl up these stairs. They're falling off on the runway behind. We're leaving behind a stream of people. The plane is picking up speed, heavily overloaded. The tail is sinking badly. We're trying to get everybody up front. They're taking off on the most rough runway takeoffs I've ever had, but this World Airways crew has done a fantastic job. The men on board are cheering. But it's hardly a case of cheering, I should think. These men have left behind hundreds of thousands of women and children who should have gotten on. We only got on about two or three women and maybe a half dozen kids. We're up in the air. We are out over Da Nang. We seem to have everybody on. This was the most terrifying experience I've ever had in Vietnam.
Radio news at CBS over the last quarter century has been concerned with the domestic front as well as with foreign coverage. The wars the nation fought overseas left their scars at home, which were to manifest themselves as the 1960s unfolded. The decade started off shaped by the ideals of Camelot, but the ideals needed implementation that not everyone was willing to undertake. Increasingly, news coverage documented that the poor and minorities were not treated equally in this country, in education, public accommodations, in voting rights. Martin Luther King, a black minister from Atlanta, emerged as one of the spokesmen for the black cause, and at a Washington rally in 1963 gave a speech, carried on CBS radio, that seemed to exemplify all the resentments and hopes.
I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up, live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Yeah. This will be the day. This will be the day when all of God's children will be able to sing with new meaning, "My country, 'tis of thee." Sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. So let freedom ring. From the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire, let freedom ring. From the mighty mountains of New York, let freedom ring. From the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania, let freedom ring. From the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado. But not only that, let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside. In every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last, thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
In the years before Martin Luther King's stirring speech, the process of trying to integrate schools and universities in the South had caused violent opposition and confrontations, like the first one at Little Rock, Arkansas in 1957. President Eisenhower.
Under the leadership of demagogic extremists, disorderly mobs have deliberately prevented the carrying out of proper orders from a federal court. I have today issued an executive order directing the use of troops under federal authority to aid in the execution of federal law at Little Rock, Arkansas. This became necessary when my proclamation of yesterday was not observed, and the obstruction of justice still continues.
And Governor Orville Faubus of Arkansas replies.
1,200 troops of the 101st Airborne Division were flown into the Jacksonville Air Base by air transport from Fort Campbell, Kentucky. Immediately thereafter, these troops occupied in force the grounds of Central High School. We are now an occupied territory. The tragedy of the whole situation is that the imported judge, by exercising a little patience and understanding, or by the taking of testimony to gain the facts, could have averted the whole development. The federal government has made a grave and grievous error in the federalizing of the Guard and the use of federal troops. The troops are even inside the school building, accompanying the Negro students from class to class. School attendance at Bayonet Point is not compatible with the American way of life.
And finally, after the confrontations and the marches and the sit-ins, it took the death of a president to expedite the passage of three civil rights bills of 1964, 65, and 66, which guaranteed voting rights and open housing, a culmination of a protracted story covered extensively on CBS Radio. President Lyndon Johnson spoke to the nation.
All I have, I would have given gladly not to be standing here today. An assassin's bullet has thrust upon me the awesome burden of the presidency. No memorial oration or eulogy could more eloquently honor President Kennedy's memory than the earliest possible passage of the Civil Rights Bill for which he fought so long.
But President Johnson was not successful in setting a course the nation would follow in Southeast Asia. All across the country, students were dropping out of school in protest of our policies there. Some went on peace marches or set up communes. Others made bombs that killed and disrupted life around them. Most said they were going to make the world a better place, but there were many in the land who doubted young people's motives. And in the continuing surge and counter-surge of Vietnam protest, a group of students was fired on by the National Guard at Kent State in Ohio in 1970. Four were killed. National Guard General Robert Canterbury.
Many members of the crowd closed in on our troops and assaulted them with rocks. Many guardsmen were hit by rocks about the size of baseballs. At that point, the guardsmen fired many tear gas rounds at the crowd. In fact, fired all tear gas rounds on hand at that time. The order was given to return to the commons, and the troops moved out. A crowd estimated at several hundred closed in and assaulted the guard force again with rocks and pieces of concrete. These guardsmen considered that their lives were in danger, which in fact was the case.
The father of 19-year-old Allison Krauss, one of the victims.
She resented being called a bum because she disagreed with someone else's opinion. She felt that war in Cambodia was wrong. Is this dissent a crime? Is this a reason for killing her? Have we come to such a state in this country that a young girl has to be shot because she disagrees deeply with the actions of her government?
The stories covered by CBS News overlaid each other as the 1960s ended and the 70s began. One of them was the condition of women. The Supreme Court gave limited approval to abortion, and people of both sexes began reevaluating themselves and their roles. As CBS News correspondent Dan Rather reported in a CBS radio special about women in 1973.
Clearly, the American woman is beginning to avail herself of the new options opening up for her. Options she never dared consider before. The sheer number of women moving out on their own is so great and the directions in which they are moving so varied that behavioral conformity is about as obsolete as Detroit's year-end models. Of course, what must be borne in mind is that it's not simply the men who have all the readjusting to do. The American woman is having difficulties not only because some are carrying out their own experiments with independence and have male backlash to deal with, but because a great mass of American women are largely content. For while liberation has been tagged a woman's movement, the more appropriate term in the end may conceivably become a people's movement. Men and women looking at each other with new awareness.
CBS News correspondents and reporters covered the continuing story of politics and presidents. In 16 years, we elected four presidents to the Oval Office. Two gained it unelected. One was assassinated. CBS Radio on that unforgettable day, November 22nd, 1963.
Motor case, something has happened here. We understand there has been a shooting. The presidential car coming up now. We know it's the presidential car. You see Mrs. Kennedy's pink suit. There's a Secret Service man, spread eagle, over the top of the car. We understand Governor and Mrs. Connolly are in the car with President and Mrs. Kennedy. We can't see who has been hit, if anybody's been hit, but apparently something is wrong here. Something is terribly wrong.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States is dead. John F. Kennedy has died of the wounds received in an assassination in Dallas.
CBS News correspondent Alan Jackson. After that, there was a rash of similar killings. Malcolm X in 1965 and then 1968, a year of unremitting major news stories. Martin Luther King is shot. CBS Radio at the moment of crisis.
I was in room 309. Dr. King was in room 306, less than 60 feet away. As soon as I turned on the television set, he came on the screen, speaking to the audience he had addressed the night before. He was saying very powerfully that he was ready to die.
Difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. Like anybody, I would like to live.
When the program ended, I reached over to turn the set down. That was when I heard the shot ring out, and I rushed out on the balcony. I saw Dr. King lying about 40 feet away. Ralph Abernathy was there, and so was Andy Young.
Police poured down the street, running with rifles. The scene was confused and frantic. An ambulance arrived, but there wasn't much anyone could do. I knew they had killed him. It was hard to believe, after all the threats and close calls, that it had finally happened here, at a motel in Memphis, Tennessee.
That same year, Robert Kennedy, the dead president's brother, decided to run for president. The incumbent president, Lyndon Baines Johnson, decided not to.
I have concluded that I should not permit the presidency to become involved in the partisan divisions that are developing in this political year. Accordingly, I shall not seek and I will not accept the nomination of my party for another term as your president.
a surprise to almost everyone but the president himself. And then it was June. Robert Kennedy won the California primary, an evening that began for Kennedy in triumph and ended in yet more bloodshed.
My thanks to all of you, and now it's on to Chicago, and let's win there.
Senator Kennedy has been shot. Is that possible? Is that possible? It could. Is it possible, ladies and gentlemen? It is possible. He has. Not only Senator Kennedy. Oh, my God. Senator Kennedy has been shot. Possibly shot in the head. He still has the gun. The gun is pointed at me right at this moment. I hope they can get the gun out of his hand. Be very careful. Get the gun.
Take a hold of his thumb and break it if you have to. Get his thumb. All right. That's it, Raper. Get it. Hold him. We don't want another Oswald.
My brother need not be idealized or enlarged in death beyond what he was in life. To be remembered simply as a good and decent man who saw wrong and tried to right it, saw suffering and tried to heal it, saw war and tried to stop it. Those of us who loved him and who take him to his rest today pray that what he was to us, what he wished for others, will someday come to pass for all the world. As he said many times in many parts of this nation, to those he touched and who sought to touch him, some men see things as they are and say, why? I dream things that never were and say, why not?
Richard Nixon won a first term as president and then another, and in 1974 resigned from office, his career shattered by the Watergate scandal. For the next 2 years, President Nixon's chosen successor, Gerald Ford, tried to keep the nation on an even keel. And in 1976, Jimmy Carter, driving for the presidency, pledged in his campaign to lead the nation to a new beginning.
I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow. I regret deeply any injuries that may have been done in the course of the events that led to this decision. To those who have stood with me during these past difficult months, I will be eternally grateful for your support. And to those who have not felt able to give me your support, let me say, I leave with no bitterness.
My fellow Americans, our long national nightmare is over.
It's now time for healing. We want to have faith again. We want to be proud again. We just want the truth again. It's time for the people to run the government and not the other way around.
Watergate was the worst scandal involving the head of government since the Teapot Dome of the 1920s, and perhaps the worst in all our history. The Senate Watergate Committee hearings were carried in their entirety, more than 119 hours on CBS radio. Former White House counsel John Dean was a key witness.
As the president discussed the present status of the situation, I told him that all I'd been able to do was to contain the case and assist in keeping it out of the White House. I also told him that there was a long way to go before this matter would end, and that I certainly could make no assurances that the day would not come when this matter would not start to unravel. I began by telling the president that there was a cancer growing on the presidency, and if the cancer was not removed, the president himself would be killed by it. I also told him that it was important that this cancer be removed immediately because it was growing more deadly every day.
But the nation heard about its triumphs as well as its tragedies on CBS radio. The first man on the moon, astronaut Neil Armstrong, July 20th, 1969.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue.
I'm at the foot of the ladder. The LAM footbeds are only depressed in the surface about 1 or 2 inches, although the surface appears to be very, very fine-grained as you get close to it. It's almost like a powder. Ground mass is very fine. I'm going to step off the land now. It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
And the United States celebrated its 200th birthday, a vast and unprecedented challenge to CBS News radio coverage.
We lost the American colonies because we lacked that statesmanship to know the right time and the manner of yielding what is impossible to keep.
They came here in the snows of winter over a trail marked with the blood of their rag-bound feet. Americans will remember the name of Valley Forge as long as the spirit of sacrifice lives within their hearts.
Many challenges remain subjects of extensive CBS News coverage on radio as our decade winds down. The economy, energy, and natural resources, our environment, the condition of the cities, and other overriding news stories, known and unknown. CBS News correspondent Eric Severide's career in news has spanned this era in which CBS News has moved toward maturity. Severide reached retirement age in 1977, but recently in a CBS News radio special dealing with American wisdom, he commented on what our past has taught us and our ability to meet the challenges that lie ahead.
There remains in the American spirit an implicit belief that problems can be solved. Maybe there is an innocence about this country's approach to life. And this innocence gets us into a lot of trouble. Yet this instinct amounts to a kind of wisdom, for it bears on the preservation of the species. It makes creativity possible. It says yes to life and no to cynicism, which is death for the spirit. Man may be trapped between earth and a glimpse of heaven, but no people fasten on the glimpse so steadily. With all our innocent and damaging mistakes, the world is fortunate in the end that one great nation at least believes in a better and better life. Perhaps that is why millions of people in other lands still want to come here. America is not what's wrong with the world. For ordinary people, it is the best thing that ever happened to the world. And this knowledge, this wisdom, is a calm eye at the center of the hurricane of our self-criticism, our periodic self-doubt.
The development of broadcast news, a 50-year experiment on CBS radio, that continues. Tomorrow will teach us something else.
And now, Bill Schallert with a closing word from General Electric.
Next year, the General Electric Company will be 100 years old. And tonight, you've heard about some of the progress that General Electric research has made possible in those 100 years. If the past is any guide to the future, they'll keep right on making it. Energy, transportation, the environment, those are just some of the fields where GE is working right now. And as you might expect, they're making progress. Progress for people from General Electric.
Now, with a closing report, CBS News correspondent Walter Cronkite. Radio has changed as America's listening habits have changed. During the 3 hours of this CBS Radio's 50th anniversary special, we've been hearing how it used to be. Today, radio at CBS sounds like this.
First Line Report.
I'm Bob Schieffer, CBS.
This is Dallas Townsend with the CBS World News Roundup.
Newsbreak. Charles Osgood on the
News
CBS.
Newsbreak PM. This is Reed Collins.
What's
reporting.
Happening? I'm Stephanie Shelton reporting
the
on the CBS.
World of Religion.
I'm Douglas Edwards, CBS.
And the Spotlight. This is Lee Jordan.
The
in
Law and You. I'm Fred Graham. CBS.
It's your Earth. I'm Nelson Benton.
The CBS Radio Mystery Theater. Welcome. I'm E.G. Marshall.
Good morning. Jim Kelly with the Sports World Roundup on the CBS.
Pat Summerall on the CBS Radio Network with predictions.
Win Elliott, Sports Center at USA for the...
I'm Ron Weber with Sports Time.
I'm Brent Musburger with Sports Time.
Time now to meet the cook. Ralph Story here.
This Line America. I'm Charles Carroll.
Washington Watch. I'm Bruce Morton, CBS
News. This is Charles Collingwood reporting.
Face the Nation. A spontaneous...
Morley Safer's Journal commentary.
Mike Wallace at Large on
the CBS.
This
is Lawrence Johnson on the CBS Radio Network with What's New and Learning.
Reporter at Large. I'm Leslie Stahl, CBS.
I'm Phyllis Schlafly for Spectrum.
This is The World Tonight. Good evening. I'm Douglas Edwards.
This is Walter Cronkite reporting.
Today in Business. I'm Ray Brady reporting.
Mormon Tabernacle Choir from Temple Square in Salt Lake City.
William S. Paley, who was there when it all began, remains firmly committed to radio as a central method of modern communication.
Radio is a very important medium. I don't think most people realize the importance of it. From the standpoint of national security, it's absolutely essential. It's the only medium that can reach all the people at a moment's notice, no matter what calamity might befall the country. So it's a necessary medium. And at the same time, of course, it takes care of people who either don't like television or who are too busy to be sitting in front of a television set, who want to walk around and be entertained or informed. It's becoming more and more of an information medium. Oh, it's really divided almost in two. Either stations that put a great accent on music, practically nothing else, with just a few minutes of news every once in a while, and stations that put a great accent on information and discussion. And we chose the latter course. It's a more expensive way of going about it, but it does provide a very important service. And I think it's a product that is indestructible from the standpoint of the kind of demand that there will always be for it. I pride myself in the quality of our news organization. It's certainly by far the best of any organization in broadcasting, and I think it compares favorably with any organization, even in the print media. And therefore, we're better equipped to do an all-news station operation than almost any other network or any other organization.
William Paley. For the last 3 hours, we've been sharing with you a look back at CBS Radio's first 50 years. Undoubtedly, there were voices and sounds you expected to hear and did not. We hope that those you did hear, you enjoyed. They may have carried you back, and perhaps in the larger picture, informed you. I'm Walter Cronkite, CBS News.
You have been listening to a special 3-hour CBS Radio anniversary broadcast. CBS Radio at 50, an autobiography in sound, sponsored by General Electric. This broadcast was written and produced by Joan Martin Burke with Maurice Lee Robinson. Technical supervision, Mortimer Goldberg. Assistant to the producers, Martin Werber. Research, Catherine Sulks. Executive producer, Dick Reeves. The entire production was supervised by Emerson Stone. Bob Height speaking. This is the CBS Radio Network.